Okay, folks, hearing from Mother Earth, profiteers versus protectors, land, trees, water, and seas, next steps. So, where are other, oh, there's Serena. So, my friend John Peck, Family Farm Defenders, I'm Nancy Price, Lions for Democracy. And Seren, who do you identify with?
The Color of Water Project.
The what?
The Color of Water
Project. Oh, the Color of Water Project in Massachusetts. So you'll be hearing from the three of us. I'm so glad that gradually assembling. This is a very important topic given the climate issues and given the current issues of the administration in regard to protecting Mother Earth. So thanks for coming. John, why don't you...
Sure, I can start. So my name is John Peck. I'm with Family Farm Defenders. We're a national grassroots group based in Madison, Wisconsin. We have members in all 50 states. We're part of Via Campesina, which some of you might be familiar with. It's the largest umbrella organization for family farmers, hunting, gathering, fishing, indigenous folks in the world. They just had their giant congress for Via Campesina in the Basque region of Spain last week, which we had some farmers from the U.S. at, so I'm sure you'll be hearing lots of report backs from that, what the state of agriculture is around the world and our role in that. But Nancy asked me today to talk a little bit about land grabbing, and I guess a little bit about seed grabbing, and I'm glad people are grabbing some. I brought different fact sheets, which are at our table, so if you're interested in more of these issues, definitely stop by. Family Farm Defenders has a booth or table in the main hall there. You can get more information there. So, and not to be too, I also teach, and I'm going, oh, whiteboard. So I'm just wondering, I will use it since it's here. So one thing, just to maybe get us starting a little bit, are people familiar with the concept of enclosure, what we're talking about here? Okay, so historically, we have had periods, I would argue, of enclosure movements around the world where, and I would say this is a tactic of colonialism. Okay, so what's going to happen? Well, you can think of examples. This is partly why I'm here, right? So my ancestors in Ireland were occupied by the British, forced to grow crops they didn't really want to grow. Next thing is artificial famine induced due to colonialism, and they all have to come over to the United States, right? So you could say I'm a victim of lack of food sovereignty and British colonialism. And that story can be replicated all around the world. So we talk about enclosure as a form of colonialism. So what types of things are, and I would argue that what's happening now is we're like at the, when we, Nancy and I were preparing for this, we were speaking about capitalism is so desperate now that they're looking for the last things to enclose. What are the very last things out there that we have not turned into private property, right? So that's the goal of the enclosure movement, is to basically turn common property, the commons, right? Mm-hmm. They call it the Boston Commons for a reason, right? You could take your sheep down there and graze them in the commons. Good old days in Boston. Okay. So the commons are lots of things. Can people think of some examples of common property resources that we all enjoy?
Water.
Yay, water. We're going to be talking about that today.
Trees.
Okay, a lot of forests are common property. Fish, yes. DNA.
Bees.
Wildlife. Right, all sorts of wildlife, insects, elephants, whatever could be common property resources.
And those are natural.
Bear.
But we can talk about cultural commons.
Yes, good. That's what I was hoping someone would say.
Holidays.
Languages. Sports.
Yes. Poetry.
Shakespeare. Recipes.
Wow. Music.
Music. Wikipedia just goes on and on. Okay. So, now everyone knows that you can sing the happy birthday song. You don't have to pay a royalty for it. It was finally redeclared common property last year by a U.S. court. So now the radio stations don't have to pay a fee to Warner Music, whoever it was, whoever owned it, said they owned it.
And just to say, just to say, a couple of years ago, Jan Edwards of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom coined the phrase, I'm a commonista.
Uh-huh. Yes.
So very I good. Think we should get buttons made and start wearing
buttons. Yeah, say we're commonistas. So I would, what part of the context for this for me as someone who cares about agriculture, the big sense of agriculture, is that we're fighting an enclosure movement right now, okay, over these commons, which I would argue we need to defend the commons, expand the commons, Yes. Okay. And not to, I teach economics. So I just want to give a shout out to Eleanor Ostrom, one of my heroes in economics. Anyone know who she is? Only woman to ever win the Nobel Prize for economics. You know, she wasn't allowed to be an economist because back then women could not take economics in college. She was forced to become a political scientist. She was told by a professor, you can't do math. You're a woman. Wrong.
Gee, they told me that.
Okay. Yeah, I know. Go figure. They told my mom that, too. Okay. So, but Eleanor Ostrom...
Put it here.
Huh?
When?
Oh, she won the Nobel Prize for economics in 2008, I think it was. Very recently. She's the only woman ever to win. And just recently won it. She passed away like 2 years ago. Taught University of Indiana. But her whole argument is, how many of you have heard of the tragedy of the commons? Oh my gosh, I hate teaching this in my economics class. I hate this. It's in my book, every book. Garrett Hardin. I'm sure hope Garrett Hardin and Eleanor Ostrom had a nice grudge match at one point.
Yes,
okay? Because Garrett Hardin came up with this theory, and this is a theory, 1968 science article, and the most hilarious story I'll share about this, I actually went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison Library to find the original article in the Science magazine. Guess what?
It's torn out.
It was cut out. Yes, yeah, so sliced it out with a razor blade. So it wasn't even there. Tragedy of the commons, right? So the whole argument about this is that the idea is that people are going to trash the resource. If there's no one who owns it, they're going to just destroy it. They'll overfish the lake. They'll chop down every single tree. You know, this is like the Lorax gone crazy, right? The Onceler shows up, it's all gone. So his example was like a pasture, Boston Commons. All the sheep herders are just going to load their sheep on there. The whole thing's going to be destroyed. Because everyone's pursuing their self-interest. We're all greedy maximizers, and that's it. Goodbye, commons. Okay? And so his solution is what? The World Bank solution. Privatize. The only way to save the Earth, all these precious resources we love, like clean water, clean air, our DNA, whatever, wildlife, is we need to privatize every elephant in Africa. We need to privatize every fish. And that's going to be the way to go. And the World Bank promotes this. I'll tell you right now, because I used to work for the World Bank. Talk more about that later. All right, so, privatize everything. Eleanor Ostrom's response.
Hogwash.
Well, yes, exactly. She says these people have rules. They have institutions. Those sheep herders are not going to just destroy something they depend upon. Ask any lobster fisherman in Maine. Are they going to fish every lobster out of there and destroy the lobster fishery forever? No, they've already sat down at the pub and divvied up the pots, and Joe gets 4, Sally gets 7, because she's been here longer, and when you get older, Joe, you might be able to inherit some of Sally's pots, and they figure out how to manage the resource, right? Same thing happens with elephants in Africa, same thing happens, the Menominee Forest in Wisconsin, best managed forest in the state, is managed under common property resource standards, seventh generation principle, owned by the tribe, not privatized. Right? So her solution to the commons is cooperation. I write this really big for my class all the time in economics. It's more efficient and productive. It's more efficient and productive and sustainable. Then, competition. Whoa! Talk about shocking ideas in economics. Milton Friedman would be rolling over in his grave like, whoa, Eldor, no, that's not how it works. He says, yes, it is, that's how it works. And I have all these cases to prove it over and over and over and over again.
And hundreds of years of native...
Yes, exactly. That's what she's drawing on. She's pointing all the studies out, right? So this is just to sort of lay out, you know, the problem, the challenge we have right now, I would argue one of the biggest ones is land grabbing. Okay, privatization of land. So
John,
I don't need to write any more up there.
Just who was the guy that wanted to privatize? I didn't hear his name.
Well, that was Garrett Hardin's solution.
Okay.
I mean, everybody, talk to anyone at the World Bank, they're all like that too. Okay, so what's the challenge we have right now? 400 million acres of farmland are going to be changing hands in the United States in the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Farmers are getting dying.
Baby boomers are all, right? We have this huge, so we're going to have the largest transfer of wealth in U.S. history is going to be happening in the next 10 years. A lot of that is land. Who's going to get it?
Where is it? Chinese area.
Well, there's that, but... who's going to get it? Someone's going to get it, right? I'll tell you right now, Native Americans now only control less than 2% of all the land in the United States. African Americans own less than 1% of all the land. So it's not going to be certain groups of people. We've already done the enclosure maneuver on them, right? Taking away their resources, put them on reservations, sent them, you know. So who's going to be inheriting this land? So this is going to be a big challenge, I think. Half of all farmland in the U.S. is now rented. People know that? There's this mythology that all these U.S. farmers own their land. 100 years ago, yes, 98% of the land in the U.S. was owned by the farmers who farmed it. Not anymore. Not anymore. So a lot of these farmers are like already mortgaged to the gills,
so who's
right?
Who's owning the land they're renting?
Good question. Who owns the land? Who's the largest landowner in the U.S.? Anyone know?
Catholic Church.
It's a church, yes. I was told it was a Mormon church, but the Catholics are probably pretty close later on, right?
The guy that was married to Jane Fonda for a while.
Ted Turner? He's one of the largest private landowners, but we're talking institutionally, you know, large landowners. The second largest landowner in the U.S., which most people don't even never know about, is called TIA. So hopefully somebody picked up this TIAA flyer. Does anyone know who TIAA is?
They used to be TIA Craft.
Yes, they used to be TIA Craft. Now they're TIAA. I guess they got rid of the Craft part. They're trying to put a firewall between the two for future lawsuits or something. So TIAA now is the second largest landowner in the U.S. Why are they, as a pension fund, investing in land? There's no more land, yes. So in economics, we'd call that perfectly inelastic supply curve. I won't give you the example, right? But there's only so much land. That is the ultimate resource, right? No more land, unless you start draining the ocean or invading other countries, which is how some people expand their land base, right? Or mine the moon. But we only have so much land. What's the rate of return on farmland?
Low.
Well, now it might be lower, but... a couple years ago, it was higher than the S&P 500. It was 11 to 12% return rate a year. So for a while, there's
a... improving or in the rents?
Well, both.
I mean, you know what I'm saying? Growth.
Just making money.
Yeah.
The
price of land has gone up.
Yes,
but
right.
But the corn and the soybean...
the commodity prices are going down, right.
All gone down.
Right.
So the rents have gone down, so...
yeah, well, it depends where you are. So, like, when TIA Craft buys land, they're doing it for speculative purposes, not to grow corn.
No, but what was your answer? So it went up because of the price of selling the land? They made a lot of money?
Yeah, they have a lot of money.
Yeah.
What are you going to invest it in?
So I'm saying your answer was that the land values have gone up.
Yeah, where they bought up land. So one of the problems is speculation leads to increase in prices, right? I mean, well, all of us like prices that are stable and predictable, right? As consumers, I'd love to be able to go to the store and see that bread is still the same price as it was yesterday, not $10 a loaf now, okay? Or as I go to the gas pump and I like it when gasoline is like a normal price. Who likes it when prices go like this?
Investors.
Speculators love this. This is chaos. This is a great way to make money. This is why they love to be in Chicago at the Board of Trade, playing with the corn market. Those guys buying and selling corn in Chicago do not care less about what the corn is used for.
Isn't it really controls all the commodity market?
Well, 60% of the commodities sold in Chicago now are not bought or sold by anyone who uses them. They're all bought by speculators. So it's third market. Right, so and that's true for natural gas. That's true for all sorts of other commodities too. So this is important to realize that speculation leads to chaotic pricing, which is not good for most of us. But some people make a lot of money off this, right? So that's what hopefully they're going to make a lot of money off this.
But how's a pension fund? I mean, how if TIA is investing in that for a pension fund, they have to keep selling it off to pay their pensions, right?
Well, they're using it as a way to make money for their shareholders, their pension clients. Yes, right. So just to give an example, when we had a Swiss hedge fund at UBS Agrivest, I don't know if people are familiar with them, but they bought 9,800 acres in Wisconsin just 2 years ago in one purchase. Imagine someone coming in, a Swiss company coming in and buying 9,800 acres in your community overnight. The current land price is $5,000 per acre. Anyone guess how much they paid for it? 7,000. So they like drove up the prices for everyone in that whole area, right? Just because they didn't care. I mean, they're just speculating, right? Whatever. We want to buy this. So they bought. So TIA at Kreft did the same thing in Wisconsin. They were buying land for almost $6,000 an acre when the prevailing price was $5,000 in that area. So you see what's going to do is drive up rent prices for other farmers, right? Make it more difficult.
You mean
for them.
Land ownership prices?
Yeah, and land ownership too. Rent, well, rent is going to follow the sale price for land, yes. So they can start getting charged higher rent.
So do we know what they're interested in using this land for?
Well, that's what we're trying to find out. So we're part of a whole campaign to try to bring about corporate accountability for TIA. If you're going to be owning this land, guess what? We have some farmers who are very concerned about what that land's being used for. Because I would argue that land is designed to provide food for people. Land is not just a commodity that you buy and sell willy-nilly as you see fit. Okay, that's not how I would treat any common property resource. Okay, and I would argue that land is it falls sort of in this category. We have restrictions on how land is used. People care about land. You cannot just do whatever you want with your land. All right, I would argue our government doesn't allow us to do that either. So land is in this, we just have something to say about how land is used. I mean, where does property come from? Not to be all like Econ 101. What is property?
It's an idea.
It's a social relationship between people over an object, which could be another person, right? We used to have slaves, right? So, I mean, property is a social relationship. Who decides what that is? The community decides that. And often we just say the government does it for us, but we're the government, right? We decide what that relationship is. All right, so that's why land grabbing, I think, is a really serious problem. And I can give you more examples if you want. And this is not just limited to the United States. I was just giving you some examples in the U.S. So in California, 5% of all the farmland in California is now owned by outside owners, non-U.S. owners. You know, what are they doing with that land? Why do they have it? Our governor in Wisconsin, we right now have a cap. We have a limit on how much foreigners can own farmland in our state. A lot of states have these limits. He wants to get rid of it.
Yeah, of course he does.
Yeah, well, but a lot of this is part of the World Trade Organization agenda, right? Capital should be able to move freely. Everything should be a commodity. You should not have any restrictions on, for instance, wholesale water bottling coming out of Lake Superior. You know, I can think of lots of other examples of this. These are all WTO provisions, right? You cannot limit any bulk export of any commodity. You cannot limit foreign ownership. No limits, right? This is we have 3 million farm owners in the U.S. Half of them don't own their land now. 50% of it's rented. A lot of it's being owned by outside agents, and including TIA, and we found out who was lobbying the governor of Wisconsin to try to lift the foreign ownership on farmland. TIA was.
Oh, really?
Why? Because the money they're going to use to buy that farmland is not necessarily from the U.S. They're a global pension fund. Mm-hmm. So they have money from Switzerland, Sweden, Germany, and all these workers with their little pension plans everywhere, putting it in every month. Piling up in TIA's war chest, and they're going around the globe with this money now, looking for investments, right?
Well,
so they're in Brazil.
It gives the bigger seller more buyers when they want to sell.
Well, do they necessarily have to have a willing seller?
No, I meant when they want to sell. If they want to cash.
Well, yeah.
Speculation,
well,
they
have a monopoly, then you can just do whatever you want, right? Like if they control all the farmland in Brazil. I mean, they're going around buying up land all over the place, right?
Do you have any way of developing an inventory?
Well, that's what we're trying to force them to disclose. So this is part of the whole corporate accountability transparency project, right? So with TIA, we're saying, well, excuse me, TIA, but we have a lot of members who actually have pensions with you who would like to know what their investments are, right? Tell us what land you're buying and why. They won't tell us. They say, oh, we bought this many acres in Florida. Mm-hmm. And I have to go dig through some obscure real estate journal to find out they were buying sugarcane land from this other company. And these are the neighbors. But I'd be like, I should be able to just open up a corporate report and find that out as a TIA shareholder, pension client.
Can't you use FOIA to find that out?
Nope. So we're putting pressure on them to try to release this type of information. And then obviously, the flip side of that is we would like them, if they're going to be the biggest landowner in the U.S. after the Mormon Church,
They have to have a responsible land ownership policy. Like, if you're going to own all this land, why don't you say, well, we're going to have 10% of our farmland be used for beginning farmers?
Yeah.
Or organic production. Or I can think of lots of really good things that you're doing with all this land, since there's such a socially responsible pension fund, as all their documents say. Why don't you really put your money where your mouth is? And so we're not, you know, it's not just farm groups concerned about this, and we have, you know, Rainforest Action Network, Friends of the Earth, and there's all these other groups, because they're doing this worldwide, you know, what can we do about it? So that's just an example of one campaign dealing with farmland. And I know, Nancy, I can, I'll wrap up here a little bit because I'll have time for questions, but you wanted to mention the seeds.
Yes,
the
absolutely.
Seed issue, too. Okay,
but
so...
could you say something about... because I'm sure you know all of this,
no,
about
not, no,
land grabbing for biofuels.
Yes, right.
And
okay.
In Indonesia and Africa, and how what's happening to the displaced workers in that regard.
So in part, then if you picked up this fact sheet here, that's a little bit more about the land grabbing in Brazil and Indonesia and other countries. So, I mean, what's happening there is TIA is basically buying up land that then they sublease or lease to palm oil production. So one thing, I mean, we can have a whole other workshop sometime about how agrofuels are a disaster in so many ways. Okay, so we're talking ethanol and biodiesel, right?
Yeah.
Ethanol has bankrupted many farmers in the U.S. already, and then, of course, biodiesel is destroying the tropics. Okay, so what we're going to be, you know, the palm oil industrial complex, or if you want to call it, is a real problem in the South, right? And who's bankrolling this? You know, companies like TIA are providing the land, and then they're leasing it to palm oil companies to put in palm oil. I've been to these palm oil plantations in many countries. It's horrible. The result, I mean, you're basically creating an ecological desert. You're destroying native rainforest.
Wildlife.
Yeah, orangutans, homeless. It just goes on, right? Indigenous people displaced, driven out of their homes. All for export.
Their employee force. They
yep. It's like
them as
indentured servitude practically on these plantations. So it's just not a happy... Yeah. I mean, I would argue it's a maldevelopment model. Mm-hmm. So we're like,
what
we're going...
What kind of fuel is it used for? I thought palm oil we ate it.
Well, that too. Ooh. Yeah.
But mostly it's fuel?
Well, biodiesel and fuel, food. If you're really interested in... This is about palm, you know, what products there's palm oil in.
Oh.
So if you want one of these, grab one of these, and then... Here it sort of explains how production of ethanol and mostly biodiesel, is actually a carbon problem. I mean, we end up putting more carbon in the atmosphere than we're saving.
I had no idea what you did.
So that's explained here a little bit. So that's the palm oil thing. We can get more into that if we want, but that's...
You want to talk about the GE eucalyptus trees a minute?
Well, yeah, well, okay. There's a lot of genetically engineered, yes, a lot of GE trees. We are one of the groups that's opposing the GE eucalyptus, which is just being approved in the U.S.
What are they going to use that for?
Well, probably biomass, burning. Yeah, I mean, it's horrible for a lot of other things. But the idea is, like, it's genetically engineered, so it'll grow really fast, it'll be frost-resistant. This is a frost-resistant version. So we could have weedy eucalyptus growing up into Canada out of control, right? And, yeah, eucalyptus belongs in Australia,
yeah.
My opinion.
It's already an invasive in California.
Yes, and they pay people in South Africa to rip it out because it drains groundwater levels. It's an ecological desert. Nothing eats it. It's a problem, right? But the World Bank loves you to plant eucalyptus. That's money for that. Plus carbon credits. You get carbon credits.
Yeah.
Planting trees that no one can use really well. And so for seeds, I guess I would argue that seeds are another common property resource that we need to not let be enclosed. So if you're thinking about who owns seeds now, I mean, you probably know the companies, right?
Monsanto.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch. There's like three or four of them that now basically control 80, 90% of some seed varieties. And the big problem with the patented seeds is you don't own them, right? You rent them. Right?
They reproduce themselves.
And they're promiscuous. So they go all over the place. I mean, this is like one of the lawyers for the Canadian farmer
people know the story.
Yeah. Percy Schmeiser.
Percy Schmeiser's lawyer says this very well in one of the movies. Like, well, this is not like a carburetor. My carburetor's not going to walk off the car and make more copies of itself when it's patented. But your seeds are doing that every day, right? So these are living life forms that are going out there and reproducing themselves. They're cross, breeding with other things. So now we have, mutant seeds, right? Roundup ready, resistant, weeds everywhere, 70 of them now. So this is one of the problems with seeds. And then, of course, the patent, now if it becomes property, and our group would argue that no living life form should be private property.
I agree, too.
And that is a principle of food sovereignty. No life form should, so whether it's genetically engineered salmon, not allowed, GE eucalyptus, not allowed, you cannot be privatizing people's blood, which is happening in this country.
Right.
Okay, so all that should be off the table. That's all. In fact, if you go to Iceland, who owns the DNA of everybody in Iceland? People hear this story? The Icelandic government finally said, all you bio pirates coming in here stealing our DNA, because all the people in Iceland have this weird Viking ancestry. They have all sorts of weird genetic stuff going on there, which is really valuable now. People are bio-prospecting, bio-pirating all around the world looking. So the Icelandic government said, okay, we're going to put a kibosh on that.
That's good.
And we're going to say all this DNA in our country is government, state, whatever, our property. You can't come in and just steal people's blood and patent it on against their will, right?
Wow.
And a lot of native people are thinking about doing the same thing.
Iceland arrested the Rothschild bankers.
So that's one of the challenges with seeds, right? So I would argue, people might be familiar with the open source seed movement. Okay, so the whole idea of open source software, a lot of people are familiar with this idea for software, right? Why not for seeds? So I will share my seeds with you. You can improve them, whatever, but whatever you come up with must also be open source for everybody else to use, too. So I can share my seeds, and you can certainly sell the seeds, but you can't make them your private property.
Right.
So if you want to sell the seeds at cost, like, oh, it cost me $1 to put in this bag, great, fine, I'll give you $1 for it. But you don't actually own it. No one's going to be renting them. Once they get it, that's theirs to do stuff with, right? So this whole idea, he was on my PhD committee at UW-Madison, and Jack Klottenberg, who wrote a great book called First the Seed. If anyone wants to read about privatization of the seed industry, he wrote a great book about it, how it happened, right? Land-grant colleges used to develop open-source seeds. That was their mission. Land-grant college, develop good seeds. Give them away for free to farmers. Open-pollinated varieties. What happened to that? He talks about how it got commodified and then privatized and corporatized, right?
But there's still a lot of that. You can get heirloom seeds.
Yes, you can still, but some places they're making it illegal, right, to seed save. Right? In Haiti after the earthquake, USAID went in there and tried to destroy the Haitian seed industry. They're going to force them to use hybrids and GMOs.
Yeah.
They tried to criminalize all the seed swapping that was going on in Haiti. So there was this effort all around the world to try to control seeds. And that's why the open source seed movement is so important. So getting seed libraries set up in your public libraries. This is a resistance strategy, which I really encourage people to do. Encourage open source seed breeding. Talk to researchers. I mean, we have the top carrot breeder in the U.S. at UW-Madison, and he's doing all his carrots open source. All my carrots. I'm not going to be working on any patented carrots ever again. And so if you want my research, it's going to be open source. I mean, how did we cure polio? That was not a private EpiPen scenario. We're going to charge people $quadrillion to cure polio. That was decided to be common. That was a common property decision, right? Everyone should be able to get the cure for polio, right? So the same. I would argue the same thing for seeds. So we wanted to talk about water and that. So let me just stop there. We have time for some questions.
Well, there's
at the end. So.
So, sir, I wanted to talk about water for a minute.
Did you say that the Mormon Church was the thing we don't have?
That's what one of the articles I have here talks about.
Wow.
Yeah. The Catholic Church is not far behind, but I think TA is second.
Okay. So I have a short presentation of water, four major points dealing with a very particular example, a very modest example. So we've talked about big picture issues about property, how it's constructed, and maintained through ultimately coercion by the state. Our example, and when I say our, I'm referring to Dorothea and myself. We've both been working on a campaign in Boston, a Boston-based campaign dealing with the human right to water. Mm-hmm. However, it's a very narrow campaign in the sense that we are focused on standards for granting access to water. So I'll say a little bit about that, but try to relate it to the broader problem of privatization. About 15 years ago, we were working on a campaign dealing with bad jobs, you know, contingent work, day labor, temp labor, those kinds of things. And one of the things one of the workers was impacted by this, came in and said, our water is cut off. I notice you guys have a lot of material on privatization and all. What do I do? And we had nothing to say to this person. He wanted to know practically, how do I get my water turned back on? You know, because he came to see us about jobs issues, not about water, but we had nothing to say. So we began to research the situation in Massachusetts. What we found is that our water in Boston in particular is provided by a public water provider. So we thought, surely there cannot be a problem with that. That's what we're about. We want the public sector to control everything. Mm-hmm. And then we began to look further into the question. And what we found is that throughout Massachusetts, virtually all the water is public. There are a few isolated cases. We became involved in two battles, one in Lee, Massachusetts, in the very western end of the state, and one in Lawrence, Massachusetts, in the northern end of the state. And we helped win those two battles. This is the early 2000s. One of the things that Massachusetts has is, as part of its constitution, a provision that water is a right, not a human right. And what the way they operationalize that principle is as follows. Because water is a right, we have to protect the sources of water, which means protecting the Connecticut River Valley, where Boston and eastern Massachusetts receives most of its water from. So there's a lot of good language in the state constitution protecting water sources, so you can't develop land in certain ways and all of that. So these are all good starting points for reinforcing the notion that water is a commons, right? It is something that ought to be protected. However, it did not extend in the other direction, which is, do we all as human beings have a right to water for our own consumption? That's not in the constitution, right? In other words, somebody could charge you money for it, okay? Certainly, we need to process the water, we need to pipe it to your house. So there are costs involved in it. It's not just the cost of water itself. It's the cost of bringing the water to you, right? So we could understand that. But what happens if you don't have the ability to pay for it? There are no protections except that which have been gained through little struggles here and there with the public utilities. So I'll just say a little bit about how this plays out and how it relates to anti-privatization struggles. We also noticed another thing happening. There was a strong interest in privatizing water from a number of different sectors. One of the larger water transnationals is very active in the state, Veolia, and it's active not so much in water, but in providing a whole lot of other services to public sector institutions, including bus transportation, these kinds of things. So the water privatizers are in the state, but they aren't about privatizing water right now. And we actually conducted a survey. We called up every city and town in Massachusetts, more than 300, to find out what was going on with water. And generally, there were no real attempts to privatize it. However, what we've uncovered is a lot of stealth attempts to privatize water. Among the stealth attempts are some things that are fairly routine business practices, right? So a group of engineers develop a set of skills, and they're working for the public utility, right? And so they have the skills they need to do this service well. Well, what if they decide, we'll take early retirement? Who has this knowledge now of this water system that the public paid for? This group, usually white guys, older white guys, have these skills. They're outside, they're in the private sector now, and they come back as consultants to the corporation. So all of these things figure into the cost. So this is a fairly routine form of stealth privatization of water. There's another way in which this is happening too. in order for the water utilities to set their prices and all, they consult with a lot of outside groups to figure out what the price of water should be. And all of these services are not provided by the government. In fact, the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection outsources this work to another large construction company, as it happens, that does have a division that surveys water, figures out the costs, and then provides recommendations and standards against which the water provider can act like a responsible, you know, corporate entity that has looked at what the market can afford and is able to offer the service. So even though most of these entities are public, the private sector really helps shape the agenda. And so what is our response? How do we respond to it? What we did in Boston was as follows. We looked at water across the city, and we looked at who was getting their water shut off. So this all began with our inability to answer the question, what do I do if my water is shut off? And the reason I'm giving our example is that I think it helps suggest a way for us to challenge privatization without a lot of resources. We're not a huge NGO with a big staff or anything like that. We're people sort of just doing citizen, I'm not a citizen, but doing the equivalent of citizen activism, right? We asked the public body then, it's called the Boston Water and Sewer Commission, what's going on with water? You know, we'd like to know where water is being cut off, and they refuse to provide us with the information, right? And it's a public body. So we kept bugging it, and they said, well, go ahead and file a Freedom of Information Act request. So because it's a public body, we could do that, right? Mm-hmm. And as we were beginning to do that, one of the city councillors helped us get the data from them. The important thing here is that if it were a private body, there'd be no chance that we could get it except for the possibility that they would feel embarrassed, right? Mm-hmm. But because it's a public body, we have these tools. And so we got the data, and what we were able to show is basically if you live in, and to use black as a kind of catch-all for various groups of people of color, if you lived in black Boston, you're 10 times more likely to have your water shut off than if you're in white Boston. So we pointed out this disparity, and there were some modest changes that the city began to make with respect to water. So small victories. But among the most important of them was that they began to acknowledge that there is a right to water. They didn't want to use our language. They began to talk about it as a right to service. And then they began to introduce a number of protections to keep people from being cut off. In other words, just a little bit of agitation, not a real community mobilization, resulted in them making changes. And from our point of view, how does this relate to privatization? The idea is this, that the stricter standards you hold the public sector accountable to, the less you're raising social expectations, mm-hmm. right? That idea about property being a set of social relationships. Mm-hmm. We're raising expectations. When we raise expectations, right, we begin to immunize the public sector against privatization. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's harder for a company to come in the way, say, Bechtel did and Bechtel and a few other corporations did in Bolivia and sort of get the water privatized and then basically take the money and run and not provide the water, right? But so to the extent that you have an engage, and again, to use another cliche, an engaged citizenry. An engaged citizenry with respect to water then meant contacting, challenging the city body to provide us with data, and then going to all the public meetings and talking with them about it. As a result, they cannot conduct their meetings in secret, you know. Effectively, until we had shown up, right, we literally went to a meeting, and everyone in the meeting turned around to look at us, because everyone else in the meeting was either a board member of the water body or a staff person of the utility. We were the only outsiders, and you're sort of not used to being stared at, but these people were staring at us, wondering what we were doing there. But it did suggest to them, you know, that people are watching. And this was just a small number of us being able to have this kind of an influence.
Like so, five, six?
Well, in the beginning it was like you, I, and about three or four of us, yeah. Yeah, and then seven. And, yeah. However, there... there's another part to all of this, right? What is also privatized when a lot of subcontracting is being done? So one of the interesting things is the Constitution requires that the utility recover all the costs, right? And it must recover it from the people who are getting the services, right? So this introduces an interesting dynamic of inequality here, because the people performing the services don't live in the same area getting the services, right? So you find a lot of suburban contractors come into the city, they make their living there, they get paid by the public body to provide these services, and then they go off and have their lives in their own neighborhoods. In other words, the city is subsidizing the suburbs in some respects, right? So we need to know about this, and the only way we found that we could learn about it, because they don't have to provide us with all the data about who they're subcontracting to, is by having community meetings, and it is through talking with other community groups where people talk about it, and people, you know, will provide you with the information in ways that are not obvious, right? They're not going to give you a spreadsheet, right? But they will tell you about the time the water leaked and the sky was rude to them when he came to talk about how to get the water reconnected. So that's how data comes to you, and that's how we need to be engaged with people. The data could be processed by real professionals, and should be. At some point, we should be powerful enough to have our own set of experts look at the data. But alongside that, we'll always need to be having conversations with the public in order to take ownership in a public way of the resource that is still nominally ours. So that's been sort of our model of work. Essentially, increase the standards, monitor the enforcement of those standards by engaging with people as well as the public utility, and making use of all the regulations available to us. And we believe that that's the way to immunize against privatization. By the way, the language in Massachusetts about the Constitution and the right to water proved very effective when there began to be a lot of exploration to think about fracking. Fortunately for us, there isn't a lot of the fracking potential in Western Mass isn't that great, and so that threat is probably reduced for now, but who knows as the technology develops. Sorry, please go ahead.
You said that there was a more likely chance of a non-white person having their water cut off. And I'm wondering what would be the justification of cutting it off? And then how would that make that future use of that, if that person were to get water again, how does that make it privatized? I don't understand how cutting off the water, what justified it, and then how that impacts privatization.
Okay. So, The most common reason given for cutting off water is the failure to pay your water bill, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a whole lot of neighborhoods where it is very difficult. Massachusetts, in Boston in particular, water is in the top third price tier within the nation, right? Mm-hmm. So even though it's a water surplus area and all of that, water is still very expensive in Massachusetts. And there are good reasons for it. The cleanup of the Boston Harbor, you know, was what sort of drove the prices. Mm-hmm. And so urban residents are paying a lot for water. They weren't the people who polluted the harbor in the first place. They weren't the people who were negligent in enforcing the standards. And most importantly, when you clean up the harbor and create all this great waterfront property, right? Mm-hmm. It's big speculators who come in and benefit from having a cleaned up harbor. But the urban residents still pay the price, right? By having high water bills at the same time that the actual salary base for that layer of the population is contracting, right? Or people on fixed incomes losing access to their water. So that's how water gets cut off. We are arguing, though, that there should be a human right to water and nobody gets cut off. And when we create that as a standard, if we create that as a standard, it would become a challenge then for a private sector entity to come in and make a profit off of the water.
Oh, you mean it would be harder for them to
do that. And so it's not as attractive to them.
Yeah.
You know, it's not
I'll just give one. We have only one privatized water municipality in Wisconsin. It's Superior, the city of Superior. It's the only one in the whole state. Mm-hmm. They're guaranteed a 9% return rate.
Wow.
It's part of their contract with the citizens of that town. So they pay a water bill that's twice as high as the average for the rest of the state.
So why would the town do that?
That's a good question, but that's the example of what a privatized water supply would do to you.
Yeah.
In Wisconsin, they were buying water rights around Lake Superior.
I think there's a Great Lakes Compact which denies a lot of these practices, and it's a transnational, a good transnational agreement between Canada.
Part of what you're saying is that there is a transfer of wealth from the average homeowner who is not wealthy but helping to pay for the Boston Harbor cleanup, and that transfer of wealth is indirectly going through the water service bill into this cleanup, which goes to the land value increase. And so then how do you get the accounting transfer back to balance that?
How do you grab that back? I don't know, but I mean, I think that it's part of sort of the moral claims that we can make on the city about how you tax these things. Just like, you know, you put in a railway station, let's increase the taxes around the railway station because, you know, property values have gone up there. So there are all sorts of ways that one could go back. The thing they say about water is under capitalism, you know, water flows upward.
Yeah,
you know, at least the money flows up.
In Pennsylvania, the early water contracts were a speculator comes to the person and says, "Hey, you own the water rights beneath your property. I would like just not to purchase the property, but I'd like to purchase the water below. And would you? Here's the contract, and here's the money." And it was easy money because the people did not think that their water would be affected. And that's Pennsylvania, I understand, has really fine-tuned this. I don't know to what extent, but do you have any comments on how the speculators come and with an agreement? And again, you've said it's only the state that can intervene
I mean, I think Nancy has lots of examples of how communities have responded to Nestle and other corporations coming in to extract water from there. Is that the case?
I was going to speak a bit about that.
Yeah.
I mean, Hiroshi was here, actually helped kick Nestle Perrier out of Wisconsin.
Okay.
But then they just moved to Michigan. But he's very, he could tell you.
That's why we're old clothes and on tour. It's expensive.
Very expensive.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't know.
No, I
don't just do the answer, but I'm sure within the room there are other people. Please go.
Was this during the period of the Flint water problems in Michigan that you did your
Our work was done, starting in like 2006 and 2007, and we've done rounds of sort of research on this topic. But once the Flint sort of episode happened, there was a lot more attention. We benefited to the extent that someone can benefit from a nasty event. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, that probably counted. Thank
you. So I wanted to come first back to something that John said, which how the land grant colleges were trafficking, you might say, in open source seeds. And I live in Davis, California, where UC Davis is an old land grant college, and up through the World War II and after, they were very involved in agriculture extension work and seed development in the old traditional way, and technology irrigation development for farmers, and really providing that extension service that, in fact, in the early 19th century, a bill was passed that land-grant colleges like UC Davis would be providing that service. I think the law was passed in 1914 or something. But anyway, so just to say that UC Davis now collaborates with Mars Inc., the candy bar company, Monsanto, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They get a lot of their funding for their GMO engineering work of seeds at UC Davis. And the University of California is now the only academic university member
of something called the New Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition in Africa that was created in 2012. And to not go into the long story on this, but one of the aspects of this, their participation in this new alliance, is that they're going to try to transform African agriculture through a new second green revolution, which there are a number of African countries participating in this, where the countries create their sort of country, their country wish list and their country agenda and a compact. And then these multinationals are coming in with other groups, other NGOs and funding groups and whatnot, to sort of propose what they're going to do and how they're going to support the country in transforming African agriculture. And of course, the problem here is exactly what John was bringing up. Will the African peasant farmer and the woman farmer be able to maintain their traditional seeds and traditional ways of life and farming and their traditional varieties under the pressure of these multinational corporate seed and chemical and herbicide pesticide companies? And when you read the reports that critique the agenda of the New Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition in Africa, this is exactly the question they raise, because the rules and regulations about this alliance are so weak at the moment that there's a great fear this is going to be the case, that the traditional African agriculture, open seeds, peasant and small holder farming will be destroyed. Lots of land grabbing going on in Africa. The titles to land are not really very clear yet, and so the leasing or selling of land to other owners, probably TIA, CREF is right in there, the Chinese are right in there. Africa is going to be really a place to look at where this whole sort of seed and corporate ag agenda unfolds. Hopefully it won't unfold, but in fact, traditional farming, and they'll improve their seeds. They have to, because of climate change and other need to feed.
They're working on it.
They're working on it, but they could really be challenged by this agenda for export crops as well, you see. So it will destroy local food crops. So I want to just come to something that I really want to put on your bring up for attention, because our earlier panel was on NAFTA. So there's all this talk about renegotiating NAFTA, but one thing we have to be very clear, for example, is that water must be out of NAFTA, because of two things. First of all, water services we want out of NAFTA. So we don't want privatization as Suren has been describing it. But we also want bulk water transfers out of NAFTA, because with the American drought really increasing in many states, Canada water profiteers are looking to export water from Canada into the U.S. by pipeline. Once, many years back, there was a Canadian who had the idea that he'd haul icebergs down, but I think that idea has been resolved because of global warming. And then we had another crazy scene where some man was going to put water from the rivers in the Mendocino coast of California into huge football-sized bladders, and he was going to haul this water down to San Diego, and we put a stop to that. But Canada water profiteers are really looking to NAFTA to give them a huge profit base in the U.S. if they can build the pipelines and do whatever else they need to with infrastructure. Now, there's a rule in NAFTA called proportionality. So if one sale is made of whatever amount of water across the border, then that becomes the baseline for all other sales. Regardless of what happens to the environment and water needs in Canada, that amount of water that sets the original baseline cannot be reduced. So that proportionality clause in NAFTA is very dangerous, and we need to get rid of it, and we need to bring up this bulk water transfer sale as an example of how dangerous NAFTA is. And that proportionality clause applies to all sorts of other issues. I mean, it could be forest products, forest timber, it could be fish, it could be what other products? Not quite sure I've got a whole list right now.
But so if they sell a certain amount of water, then what happens?
Because it's cross-border trade. Mm-hmm. So the water would be bulk water in, let's say, pipelines or
trucks.
Mm-hmm. So it's sold cross-border, so it's entered into trade as a cross-border trade item. But once that happens, this proportionality clause kicks in that protects the profits of those water businesses so that no matter what the conditions on the Canadian side, let's say drought, wherever their source drops, dries up, becomes polluted, let's say, they cannot reduce that amount that they're transporting across the border.
Okay.
And so this, we the Alliance for Democracy has written about this before under the first NAFTA. And so far Canadian businesses have not really done this. But it's an ever-present problem, and I think it wasn't a problem before because the U.S. wasn't experiencing the kind of drought we're experiencing now. But I think it could really be a significant problem. And in fact, years ago, there was something called the Security and Prosperity Partnership between Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. Yes. It was a parallel agreement that came up after NAFTA. It was in the early 2000s that Bush and the president, I think it was Fox and whoever it was in Canada, signed the Security and Prosperity Partnership that never really saw the light of day. It was, and it's gone underground. But what you see of all these pipelines is part of that, because there were going to be a series of five parallel routes from Canada through the U.S. to Mexico. And these routes were going to be oil pipeline routes with water, massive water pipelines parallel to that with rail lines. And I forget what the third or fourth item. Oh, electric corridors.
Yeah.
And these are to go from Canada through to Mexico. So they've got the pipeline system basically in place. We don't want them to get the water pipeline system in place. So I just want to bring this up to you in regard to NAFTA, because it's something we have to really work for. As we're working for a reworking of NAFTA, it's not only that we get the ISDS court system out of NAFTA, but we get water out of NAFTA. And if we get the proportionality clause out of that. So one other item I wanted to bring up is the human right to water has really emerged in the last 2, 3, 4 years as one of the main avenues of lifting up the significance of everyone needing to be provided a amount of water that is affordable, sufficient, and reliable for personal and household use. And in California, in 2012, we were able to get our water code amended through the state legislature finally after 4 years, when Governor Schwarzenegger first vetoed it, and then Governor Brown finally signed it 2 years later. So we have amended our water code to state that every Californian, avoiding resident versus citizen versus non-citizen, every California resident has the right to safe, affordable, sufficient water, the human right to safe, affordable, sufficient water. So Suren and his group is in this Human Rights to Water network that's really just evolved over the past 2 years to be a very significant movement in the country now. So you hear that more and more. And so the next thing I just want to bring your attention to is there is a bill in Congress by John Conyers from Detroit, where, of course, the homeland of water shutoffs, that would provide a $35 billion dedicated amount of funds to communities to upgrade their water and sewer systems. And particularly, it would go toward upgrading and refurbishing the lines from the master water pipeline external to the house, and the lead lines that go into the house that are often lead pipelines. And it's to replace, to find out where those are located and replace those. We have the example of what Baltimore, Pittsburgh, many communities now are finding, even in Detroit, even in Flint, where they're talking about how to refurbish the general water distribution system, they're finding a lot of the service lines into the homes are lead and need to be swapped out.
And even,
so,
even in California, right?
Even in California.
You have the public lines, but then the one that goes from the public line to your house, that's your responsibility.
That's your responsibility. So this money would go to fund that that need to change those lead service lines.
Is that a bill that passed, or he's putting it
No, it's in Congress, and I don't know. Sarin, do you know the number?
I don't.
It's called the Water Act. Food and Water Watch is working very hard to get this passed. They're actually taking, a support, statements of support to city council so that city councils can pass these statements. So I think this is something that we all need to. I didn't bring a sign up sheet, so
we're on Food and Water Watch. We should.
Yeah, so all of you go up to Food and Water Watch, but we all should go to our city councils and really. If I had all the names on a list, I would send you a how-to. Maybe you can pass this around, John. Everybody would just sign up, name, email, perhaps. I'll send you information. But I think they've gotten a couple of cities now involved, so they've got statements for city councils, which is very good. And then I think another portion of this money is going to go to not only aging systems, but a large proportion is going to what they're calling a school drinking water impact, school drinking water improvement grant, so that school water systems will be improved. And I don't know if you've been in schools or even parks where you see absolutely no drinking water fountains. And you have to go put your money, you know, into a and get bottled water. So,
or even those drinking water fountains are not necessarily potable water.
No.
Because they haven't tested them as regularly.
Yeah.
In San Diego, some of our schools had lead bait or lead in their water.
I bet. Yeah. So we can all become advocates at our local community level in all sorts of ways on water issues. However, I'd like to ask, because Hiroshi's here and he worked on on this chasing Nestle out of Wisconsin, and Nestle never came back, did they? No.
Michigan.
No. Yeah, that's the problem. So, Nestle was in Traverse City, Michigan. Their production was contained for a while, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So now they're asking for an increase in production facilities and production. I don't know what the amount is that they're looking at, but I just want to say that Nestle is, we just fought back Nestle in three locations in Washington State just recently. I think three about 2 years ago, now two. They're very invested in Cascade Locks in Oregon. They're prospecting around for another site in the Northwest. They're in Traverse City again, trying to expand the amount of water they can bottle there. And on the West Coast, they're hell-bent on expanding in Maine, in the state of Maine. So they want two more big facilities. And so I'm just asking, then there's another big problem in Mount Shasta right now, where two communities are fighting Crystal Geyser, which is owned by a Japanese pharmaceutical company, which makes it very dangerous for any kind of trade agreement with Japan, which Trump is talking about. So, and they've got, in Mount Shasta, they've got two pro bono lawyers who are doing a terrific amount of work for them, so we may make some headway on Crystal Geyser's claim. But I just wanted to ask, because the Council of Canadians has a Boycott Nestle campaign, we could really lift that up and do some work on that in the U.S. because it's part of a global boycott campaign.
Still boycotting from like
40 years ago. I know. Well, this is not informed. This is bottled water. But on the other hand, when I mentioned this to my friends in Mount Shasta,
we never really started buying very much Nestle.
Right, I know. But when I mentioned a boycott Nestle to my friends in Mount Shasta, they said, no, you know, bottled water in general, we really need to perhaps. So I don't know. I'd just like to hear from those of you here who, I mean, do you think it would be worthwhile to chime in here with a boycott Nestle and help support the Council of Canadians campaign? Or should we revive a bottled water campaign here in the U.S.? A number of years ago, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom had a just say no to bottled water. Hiroshi and his wife had a no your bottled water campaign. I don't know. I think people could do local campaigns. It's just a question of what kind of impact and clout we want to have. And of course, it's related to the commons that we're talking about in terms of ecosystems and streams and rivers and thriving. The notion, you know, that nature has a right to thrive and survive. So, it's part of the... Excuse me?
There's 40 billion plastic bottles in the day.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's not recyclable. And how many gallons of oil can make one bottle?
Exactly. So, I mean, this is like the campaign we ran how many years ago. But do we want to come back to this? Frame it maybe more strongly as an aspect of the commons. And so I just like to hear from people because I'm willing to try to do it with some others, but
there's a twist to that which is that okay, we're making all these plastic bottles, but I've been at an event in Minnesota and somebody gave me a plastic cup and I said, well, okay, but I don't really want to use it. He said, no, Bob, it's okay, it's recyclable. I go, really? Yeah, it's biodegradable. It decays. Why don't we get them to use, since there are people in places that need water that's contained in something, so we don't want to say you can't take water to those people, but we want to do it in an ecological way.
Yeah.
Let's use plastic that's biodegradable.
That's right. Well, years ago, I investigated this, and they were making biodegradable water bottles out with some kind of corn product, if I remember correctly. I'm not up on the research now. Maybe John knows. But my question there was, what kind of corn product? You know, is this GMO corn with a lot of herbicides and pesticides in it? I mean, you don't just...
It biodegrades in the sunlight, and if it's staying 5 years on a Chinese dock somewhere...
Or in a landfill. It's not
So I think we need to advocate for fountains in our communities. We have some very good fountains in our communities. Portland, Oregon has wonderful fountains. I think we need to... And we need to be sure that the water coming out of those fountains is clean and pure and all the rest of it. But I think we could have some kind of bottled water campaign here at the community level. Maybe it doesn't need to be a national campaign, but really at the community level. Yeah, right.
I think there should be community-owned carbon filtration systems, and at that carbon filtration system will be all the education about what's in that municipal water supply. Instead of bring your own bag, bring your own bottle, and have people drink good water from their municipal water supply, but also tell them what's in that municipal water supply.
Good point. Well, you know, a lot of fountains do have that, you know, side place where you can put your bottle. Rhonda?
Well, part of the problem that we had those years ago when we did that is that it's an economic justice issue a lot.
Right.
You know, it costs a lot of money by stupid bottling the water. Besides how unhealthy it is for you, but a lot of communities that don't have good water have to buy water.
That's so right.
You know, it's both of those things together. And when we went to the big stores, which we did in our community, and said, are you kidding? Why are you selling this? Trader Joe's and
Costco.
You know, Costco, there was no chance that they're going to stop that because they make $1 zillion on it.
Right. But I think at the consumer level, we can
an education.
It can be an education campaign. I know that in the Central Valley, California, many of those impacted small farm communities rely on bottled water because there's nothing else to drink. So I don't mean to mischaracterize why they are using bottled water, but I think we in our communities can have campaigns, can be aware, can do what you were saying about fountains,
in South America, they make their own water filtration systems. They have a settling tank, and they have stones, and then they have biochar.
Yeah.
And they do it right out in the field in 55-gallon drums. And
right.
These are people with no resources whatsoever. Why can't we do that?
I think you're actually right. So maybe the solution is to, for all of you who belong to different kinds of community organizations, is that we do this at the community level, but maybe some handouts would be good. Or so anyway, I'll take this back to mine.
And then there's a public health aspect of, like, drinking bottled water is a lot better than drinking Coca-Cola or pop or juice even.
Yes.
So that gets a little tricky because I'd rather see people do that than drink all these sugary drinks that are public health-wise a disaster.
Not the bottled water, the plastic is endocrine disruptors and all
that. Yeah.
Yeah. Regulation of water. One guy was bottling water next to a Superfund site and it was full of radiation.
Yeah.
There's no regulation of the water.
Yeah.
And Nancy, I don't know what you sent around. This is somebody's notes on here.
Oh, that's my notes. Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Is there a sign up? Does somebody have paper they can send around and sign up sheet?
Oh, does anybody make a sign up sheet?
No. Can you make one, please? I'd really love to have all your...
I was going to say that there's been a movement to provide your own kind of metal thermos and just refill it instead of buying the bottled water.
So maybe that's the solution, but just try to raise consciousness more because
definitely.
I think it's... I'm worried about the expansion of Nestle and some of these others in particular.
Definitely,
since they're beginning to do it again, and they will be protected under the trade agreements. I mean, if Nestle, if any of these states where they're really expanding so drastically, for example, the state of Maine, and you know we have a NAFTA, or even under the WTO, there could be a trade lawsuit. That hasn't happened yet with bottled water, but it certainly could.
And not just in the U.S., but in every continent, they're doing this.
Yeah.
Well, like all the Fiji bottled water we buy here is just supporting the dictatorship in Fiji. I mean, it's not democracy there.
Not only is it supporting a dictatorship in Fiji, it's supporting a guy in California named Steve, what's his name? Steve Ratner, who is he bamboozled the state to allow him to access the state water system water, because he has huge property in the Central Valley, to be able to use the aquifer, which gets drawn out for irrigation, to then use that aquifer, because it's under his property, as a storage system, putting in state public water reserves as a storage system, and then he sells it off to L.A. Municipal Water District. So he's the man who's benefiting from Fiji water.
Yeah.
So in any case, maybe...
One thing to keep the focus on corporations at this level.
Yeah.
Nestle's making $1 billion. Half the water is municipal bottled water.
Yeah.
And then keep it on NAFTA and the trade agreements.
Right. So this is another enclosure issue. You know, enclosing springs, lakes, rivers for bottled water purposes. So anyway, thank you very much for coming. Please sign. Please sign. I don't know where the sheet is. Who has the sheet?
He's here.
Oh, good. Please sign up. I'd love to have you get some of our e-newsletters from the Alliance for Democracy. And
I think what needs to be mentioned too is I just saw in the news a couple days ago massive contamination event of the California Central Water Supply and another location I can't remember is 123 TCP. Have you read that?
I haven't read that.
Well, it was a chemical that was put into herbicides to get rid of the chemical. It wasn't an herbicide. They just put it in there to get rid of it. It's one of those inert ingredients. And now it's contaminating huge aquifers. So
in California?
Yes, there's one in the Central Valley, and there's one that's got a 6-mile-long plume, and they can't clean it up. The company ran off. I think it was Wicks Industries. They ran off, and it's not being cleaned up, and now people have to drink bottled water. So aquifers are being polluted by corporations.
Oh, absolutely.
It's insane.
Oh, it's insane. Well, it's happening in California with fracking. And of course, now they're using cracking water on our crops.
Fruits and
vegetables. And what's happened there is the almond And the almond fruit growers who don't want to use that water and who are running out of water allocations have come to my county up north and transforming all these beautiful agricultural fields where we could grow, you know, organic, this, that, and the other thing, into almond groves. And of course, almonds take a huge amount of water, and all those almonds are going to China. So that's what we call, of course, virtual water. So all of that water, which we need in Yolo County, is going off to China. So there's another commons being robbed and privatized and shipped, because all those almonds are either going by air or boat, so there's a carbon footprint. So we can really wrap this around a lot of different issues. Well, we could go on for long.
Everything is the same. That is disproportionate to the state of California, the budget. I mean, this is what Brown's plan and negotiated, Governor Brown's plan, was to have the budget that we just passed. It is to preserve the farming industry in the global trade.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No, he's very invested in that.
What do we do about the half of farmland that's going to transfer ownership?